Well, thank you for your welcome. It's good to be here with you this morning. And my apologies that I've come without my wife this morning. But the first thing that people have said to me as I walked in was, how is she? And the answer is she's through her cancer. And it's obvious that many of you have been praying for her. So thank you very much for that. One more injection to come, then she's out of it. So that's brilliant. The reason we're looking at this subject this morning is because in your Journey Together series, you've had some great stuff going on. And it's emphasized very much again and again what it means to be the people of God. And I thought, how can I add a new dimension to it? Because there really are some great videos there. I've watched them all. And you've had a tremendous teaching series. And it's just brought home what it means, what a special thing it is to be part of this body where God has broken down the middle wall of partition between people of different backgrounds and cultures and everything else, and has fused them into a new family, a new relationship that just is unprecedented in the history of the world. And people are still discovering that kind of thing. I mean, this is Adam Peaty, who's one of the greatest swimmers that Britain has ever produced. 4 times Olympic champion, 8 times European champion, 16 times something else. I can't remember it all, but he's certainly the only British swimmer ever to have won gold medals in 2 successive Olympics. And he's broken 14 world records in the course of his lifetime. He's quite somebody. But he's also somebody who has been through hard times. I remember reading about him a couple of years ago, some of the things he was saying when his relationship broke down and he doesn't see his young son much any longer. He was battling problems with drink and just questioning the whole purpose of being an athlete and what life was all about. And just recently, you may have noticed on the news this last week, he's become famous not just for the tattoos he's got all over his body, but for the one he's put in the central place on his chest where everybody can see it. And it's a cross. And underneath it says, "Into the light." And what's happened to Petey is that he's become a Christian. And this is the sort of story that's coming out about him now. God and church helped me find peace beyond the pole. He's got to know an Olympic chaplain called Ashley Null, an academic from North Carolina. And Null has helped him to get involved with a church where he's discovered the reality of Jesus. And he says this now, "Sport is not the real world," he said in an interview with BBC East Midlands Today. "I spent most can't read this thing, read it for yourselves. "I spent most of my life kind of validating, getting my gratification or life's fulfillment from my results. And that led me to some dark moments." He emphasized the importance of considering factors beyond athletic achievement, saying, "It's really living your life on a quantifiable measure of results, 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 instead of how are the people around me? How am I? How is my son? How is my family?" And discussing his tattoo of a cross, Peter revealed that he didn't have a community outside of sport and found solace and fulfillment in God and attending church. This is even worse. He said, "I started to go to church in February." It's worth quoting, but it really is worth it, because it felt like the missing part of the puzzle. "I went with Ashley, and it gives me good goosebumps just thinking about it, because I went in there, and the sermon was all about the Olympic torch passing the building in 2012, and about athletes and percentages of how they work." I don't know if somebody tipped off the vicar or not, but anyhow, there you go. "Swimming in the World Cup in Berlin last week, the words 'into the light' were seen on his stomach and his tattoo, and he says, 'I'd gone in there, into the church, this is, pretty much with my hood up. It was all pretty scary to me.'" I think, you know, if you went in a church with a hood up, that would draw attention to it. But anyway, that's weird. "And the community was just so welcoming. I felt a huge sense of peace, calmness, grounding and perspective, belonging even. It felt like I was home in a place where people understand there's a higher level to this very superficial world," he said. And now he's saying, "I am definitely a man of faith. It was not really until I went back to church, when I was burning out, that there was a community that was there no matter what, but also a community from all walks of life, from all parts of the earth. I was like, it puts a lot more into perspective. And I actually feel at home here. There are not many places on earth where I feel at home, feel warm, and feel welcome." That's the reality of the new fellowship, isn't it? "I found a lot more balance in my life," he says, "more calm, peace, and joy every day. I've really benefited from the church community. I've been made to feel so welcome. I'm not judged. I'm just Adam. It's family. I belong. I'm home. Wherever I am, it's grounding. And that's the way it's supposed to be, isn't it? He's not the only one either. This guy, Daniel Jervis, is a Welsh swimmer who points out that the guy in his particular event who holds a world record is Welsh, and he's going to win the world record himself, not just for Britain, but for Wales, because a very proud Welshman. And being interviewed at the time of the last Olympics back in Tokyo, he said this. He said something, says this journalist, I've never heard. Most athletes thank their friends and family, the team, all the support they've got from home. But he started with, I want to thank my village of Resolven. I want to thank my church, Sardis Baptist Church, and Ammanford Church in Ammanford, who've been really supportive of me. Everyone back home has been praying for me. The thing I'm most proud of in my life is that I'm a Christian, and obviously God was with me tonight, and I'm just really grateful to be representing him. And the journalist said, I've never heard any athlete or celebrity publicly name their church in interviews. Maybe for the super famous, that's to protect them from fans being able to track them down. But still, Jervis' name-checking of two churches that have been praying for him gives an extra ring of authenticity to his faith. That's a great thing, isn't it? About being part of the church, part of this new community. It's something that's unprecedented and unequaled anywhere else in the world. Other summer camps may be available, thank you, Mrs. Foles, but other organizations of the type of the church certainly are not. There is no alternative. This is God's new community. So I was thinking, well, what can I say that will add to this series you've already had? And I thought, well, perhaps what we need to do is look at the Old Testament as well. Because although the church is something new and it's unprecedented, it's something that God has been working towards right down through history, ever since the fall of mankind. Because God always intended his people to be together. We're not supposed to be lone rangers. It's because of how we're made in his image. You know the Christian doctrine of God is that he's Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, living from eternity in a relationship of unbroken love and trust and unity. Perfect balance. And that's what's built into your life if you're made in his image. And so we can learn lessons from the Old Testament, as well as the New, about what it means to be the church, what it means to live in that relationship. This is the book of Ecclesiastes. Again, I saw something meaningless under the sun. There was a man all alone. He had neither son nor brother, no end to his toil. Yet his eyes were not content with his wealth. For whom am I toiling, he asked. And why am I depriving myself of enjoyment? This too is meaningless, a miserable business. Two are better than one. And then there's a whole little section in Ecclesiastes chapter 4 about why two people can do stuff that one person can't and why we need one another. It's built into the Bible right from the word go, isn't it? And that's why I wanted to read the story of King Josiah this morning. Josiah was a very small king indeed. That's Jerusalem, where Josiah ruled the kingdom of Judah. And in area, it was slightly larger than Devon, not an awful lot bigger, but slightly larger than Devon. If you look at the number of people he was ruling over, it's slightly more than the population of Plymouth. I would not personally like to be in charge of the population of Plymouth, but anyhow, it was a tough job for Josiah. And it was all the tougher because he was surrounded by three great world empires. There was Egypt, which had been there for centuries, and they were always just next door. And whenever they wanted to breathe down his neck, they were able to do it. There's another empire, though, the Neo-Assyrian Empire, up to the north, which for the last 200 years before Josiah came along had been growing bigger and bigger and more oppressive. And Josiah had to juggle who he was supporting between those two empires with the third one in the wings as well. Because the Babylonians, who were officially part of the Assyrian Empire, had never really been assimilated, and they were starting to become an empire in their own terms. And soon, after Josiah's death, they were going to swallow up the Assyrian Empire and start becoming the biggest kids on the block. And so it wasn't an easy job to have. And Josiah, as you've heard already from Tim, was the son of kings who had basically been quite a bad lot. Hezekiah was a good one. You read about him in the book of Isaiah, don't you? And Hezekiah had ruled quite well and justly and tried to do what God wanted. But at the end of his life, some of those people from Babylon, from that new rising empire, had been to visit Hezekiah. And he'd been a little bit flattered by that. He'd shown them all the treasure that was in his treasury. And Isaiah came to you afterwards and said, the Lord says you're a dum-dum. What did you do that for? What's going to happen is they're going to invade Jerusalem, and your sons and your daughters were taken away into slavery. They'll be castrated. They'll live their lives in Babylon. And Hezekiah, who by this stage was in his 50s, which is old age, was getting very tired and just fed up with the whole battle. And he said, so when is all of this going to happen? And as I said, well, not in your lifetime, but it'll happen to your children. And Hezekiah startlingly said, the word of the Lord that you have spoken is good. For he thought, will there not be peace and security in my lifetime? He was burned out. He just lost his vision. He thought, as long as it's okay until I have my funeral, that's all right. And so this lack of vision for the future shows up in the next two kings who come along. Manasseh ruled for 55 years. He was very effective, but also it says he did evil in the eyes of the Lord, arousing his anger. All sorts of pagan customs and pagan religion started to be brought into the country. He married pagan wives, and Manasseh had an impact on the country that was absolutely ruinous. Eventually he did die, and his son Amon took over. Amon lasted for just 2 years, and once again, you see the same thing. He followed completely the ways of his father, forsook the Lord, the God of his ancestors, and did not walk in obedience to him. So he's assassinated. And then the people who carried out the military coup are assassinated themselves in turn. And out of that whole hubbub of chaos and political intrigue, Josiah, 8 years old, comes to the throne. How could he cope with a situation like that? Well, Josiah was an absolute one-off. He was somebody who knew how to get people working together and how to build a community around him like nobody else, I guess, in the Old Testament. And that just before disaster comes to the nation of Judah, God sends him along a king who shows them this is what it should be like. This is what God wanted all along. And just for a few years, there's this glimmer of light in the darkness. And I just want to draw a few lessons out of Josiah's life very, very quickly for you this morning and then leave you with it. I think journeying together in the life of Josiah meant, first of all, building trust. Second, sharing priorities. Third, including everybody, and I mean everybody. Fourth, protecting people. And fifth, staying humble. Let's just look at those five things, and then we're all done. First of all, building trust. When he took over, the kings and the people hadn't had much trust for years and years and years. And what did Josiah do? Well, I think there are three things mainly that he did. The first thing was he recognized what people contribute. I mean, look at that first paragraph that Tim read to us. The number of different groups that are mentioned there. You've got all sorts of different people. And it would be possible for the king just to wave his hand and say, oh, see that the temple is rebuilt. Will you just carry on? I'll leave it to you. He didn't do that. Instead, he recognized the contribution that's there. And you can see from the way it's written in 2 Kings 23, just how detailed the king's planning and thinking was. He talks about Hilkiah, he talks about Shaphan, he talks about the doorkeepers, he talks about the carpenters, the builders, the masons, the people who are overseers, and he's got it all sorted out in his mind about who's doing what. And if we want to build a community, we recognize everybody's contribution. We recognize what people contribute. We don't see them as competitors. We see them as part of God's plan for us, even the objectionable ones. You know, sometimes they are the most useful people for your development to have in the church. I remember Michael Griffiths once saying, look at the fruit of the Spirit in Galatians 5. One of the fruits of the Spirit, at least in the Authorized Version, is long-suffering. I remember Griffiths saying, how are you ever going to develop the fruit of the Spirit of long-suffering in your life unless there are some people in your church that you have to suffer for a very long time? And it's true, isn't it? Everybody counts. Everybody matters. Recognize what people contribute. Second thing that Josiah did was to give them their own territory. He's giving them a lot of money to go and do this job. But you see how he ends his instructions here. It's staggering, isn't it? But they needn't account for how they spend it because I know they're honest. I know we can trust them. And to give people freedom to do things, to be trusted, that is one of the most important things that can happen in life, isn't it? Do you remember, if you've ever seen the film or read the book of The Cross and Switchblade, what turned the whole gang in David Wilkerson's favor in that episode in New York was when he held a service and they came and they gave him a hard time all the way through it. And then he said, okay, we're going to take a collection. And he got Nicky Cruz, the gang leader, to take it up. And everybody thought, this is crazy. He's just going to run off with the money. And he didn't, because he was trusted. And that started to change everything. Josiah was pretty good at that. Third, he let others be heard. Shaphan goes to Hilkiah. They find this book in the temple. And Shaphan thinks, interesting book, religious book, yes, fine. And he goes back to the king. Now, with many kings, with Manasseh, for example, or Amon, you just have said, I've done the job, Lord, and he's really, really fine, on you go. Good. You know, close the door behind you. But there was an atmosphere that was different in Josiah's court. You could hang around and chat for a bit. So Shaphan said, oh, by the way, they've come across this book. And the king says, yeah, read me a bit of it. And Shaphan, who clearly doesn't understand the significance of it, reads a bit. And the king just goes absolutely pale and says, this is terrible. This is awful. If this is what God wants, what have we been doing? We've just been play acting. And Shaphan says, oh, we have. Yes. And he just doesn't understand. And nobody would have noticed the book unless there had been enough trust, enough confidence, enough communication for the secretary to say to the king, oh, by the way, there's this book. And that was what started the revolution that changed everything in the kingdom. And so the second thing you find is Josiah's got to share priorities. He's got to make sure that everybody's on the same page. If he's going to turn around the whole religious life of the nation, he's going to have everybody on his side. So what does he do? First thing is he identifies. You see that in his reaction as soon as he gets the book. The Lord is angry with us, not with my people or with you guys or with our forefathers, but with us. He makes himself part of the problem. And he's quite clear about the whole thing that, you know, I'm in this mess just as much as you are. And if we want to build a community where we're journeying together, we need to recognize and take our share of the responsibility for what that community has become. So he identifies. Second, he delegates. He doesn't rush off to see the prophetess Huldah himself. You'll see if you read on beyond the verses we read. He sends five of his top officials to a different quarter of the city to talk to this elderly, retired prophetess and say, oh, we found this book. What is God saying to us? And I think the way I read it is that he didn't even say that he was behind this. He just sent them. He gave them that job. But Huldah wasn't fooled. And so she says, she says something unusual, if you look at the verses. She says, first of all, go and tell the man who sent you, yes, disaster is coming. And then she says, and go tell the king of Judah, it won't happen in your lifetime. You are okay. Because you've repented, God's on your side. Two messages. The man who sent you, it's pretty obvious Huldah, who had royal connections and had been around Jerusalem for a long time, knew exactly where this can come from. But you see, Josiah, although he must have been burning to know how this applied to him individually, didn't even ask that. He just sent five of his top brass and said, you go, you talk to her, you sort it out. Because he wanted them included in the whole thing. And he got that extra message from God as a result of not putting himself forward and not seeing it as something about him. It was about all of them. Third, he communicated. He got the whole people together. He read the book of the law to the people and said, folks, we are in a mess and this is why. He did it in the most public way possible. He stood by one of the two great pillars that were on either side of the door as he went into the temple, two of the most important places in Jerusalem. That was the pillar that he had stood by when at 8 years old he'd been crowned king. That was where all of the kings of Judah stood after their coronation so that the people could see them and get to know them properly. And there, standing there, he said, we've got to do something about this. And he got everybody involved. And that leads us on to the third thing. He had to make sure that everybody was behind this. The country had been going to the dogs for years and years and years. If you're going to change the culture of an entire country, what do you have to do? And he makes sure, as you can see, if you read through the rest of the story, how all of the people get involved. First of all, there were the priests. Okay, he was in charge in Jerusalem. And he could make sure that the priests in the temple, who were close to this, the corridors of power and the operations of government, were doing what he said. But it's a different thing doing something in Westminster from in the West Country, isn't it? And out in the countryside, he had to get people on side. So what does he do? He calls up all of the priests from the countryside into Jerusalem. And they must come in fear and trembling, thinking, whoa, I don't know about this. What's he going to do to us? He could kill us all. We have been involved in some of this worship that's gone on of false gods and things like that, as well as worshiping God. What's going on? And he recognizes them as priests. He gives them a meal together with the priests in the city. He gives them honor. He treats them all as one. They couldn't perform in the temple. They weren't at that grade. It was beyond their pay grade. But nonetheless, they were recognized. And also, there were the country folk, the people that lived out there in the countryside. What was going on in Jerusalem? Why were all these altars suddenly being smashed? They might have known nothing about it. And so he goes on a tour around his entire kingdom. And he goes round, taking down the pagan altars, desecrating the pagan places. And then it says he returned to Jerusalem. He does it himself. He doesn't just send out instructions. This is not something done by the secret police or the top military. This is something done by Josiah in person. And so he makes sure that as he goes to different regions, he shows people all over the country, he's concerned about them. This is not some kind of new fad in Jerusalem. This is something that involves the whole country. They're included too. Then he gets all the people together in the temple. He reads the word of the Lord, and he has a massive Passover feast for them, such as it says in the parallel passage in the book of Chronicles, 2 Chronicles, there's never been a Passover like this since the days of Samuel. You know, that was 500 years before. If you think back 500 years from here, Henry VIII was just getting to know Anne Boleyn. Columbus had just bumped into some islands and said, oh, this is India. He was wrong, it was America. You know, that's 500 years ago. It's that far back. And so Josiah made history because he wanted everybody involved. And it also says in Chronicles that when they came to worship God, it was kind of, oh, so we're going to have to kill the fatted calf away and get rid of our sheep and stuff like that. This is going to cost a fortune, boys. From his own flocks, he took 30,000 sheep and lambs and 3,000 cattle so that everybody was able to sacrifice and worship God. Bad news for the cows, bad news for the sheep. Great news for the Israelites. So everybody was included. Fourth, he was somebody who was concerned about protecting people. He wanted people to be protected as he did this. It is possible in Christian ministry to do things that look big and look stupendous and may actually achieve an awful lot for the kingdom of God and yet hurt people. 4 years ago, this guy was recognized as perhaps the greatest apologist in the world. In fact, Billy Graham said, one of the great Christian apologists of our time. And this guy had been running a youth camp in the summer for over 25 years, which was the biggest Christian youth thing in Britain. And he was acclaimed by Justin Welby as having made an outstanding contribution to evangelism and discipleship amongst young people. Got the MBE for it. I don't need to name names or whatever because most of you know who they are. But 4 years on, how things have changed. The stories that came out after this guy's death. Well, his organization said as they closed their doors, we grieve for all the victims. No words are adequate or even appropriate. Great Christian worldwide ministry, but so much hurt. People not protected from the evil that one man had allowed into his life. And this guy, well, his closest friends started talking about the way in which his manipulative abuse had affected so many people. Matt Redman, the Christian songwriter and singer, said, since the age of 13, working under this guy's authority, physical, psychological, and spiritual abuse, it still affects me to this day. Horrendous things go on sometimes, and we need to face up to that in Christian ministry. Josiah was determined that wasn't going to happen with him. And so he tried to protect people. First of all, he minimized the dangers. When you read the verses that talk about him pulling down the altars and burning chariots and taking things off the roof and smashing them and leaving the debris lying about in the valley so that everybody in Jerusalem could see it from day to day, it all sounds horribly final, doesn't it? Sounds almost vindictive, but he wasn't being vindictive. What he was doing was just making sure that nobody was going to be able to do that stuff again. If anybody in the future said, oh, come on, let's just go down to Tophet after dark tonight and have a little pagan sacrifice, just for old time's sake, what do you say? Somebody else would immediately say, you can't do that. The magic's gone. You know, they've ground down people's bones and put them all over, and that takes all the magic away. So you can't use it. It's useless. It's finished forever. And that was the way in which Josiah was trying to protect people. He also honored the past. As he was taking people's bones that nobody wanted anymore and using them to destroy and desecrate the high places, he came across one grave and said, whose is this? And he said, oh, this is the grave of the prophet from 1 Kings chapter 13. He prophesied 50 years ago that something like this would happen. Now, that is one of the weirdest chapters in the Old Testament, believe me. And this guy was certainly not 100% in his ministry for God. I don't know what goes on in that chapter at all. But nonetheless, flawed as he was, Josiah looks at this guy from the past and says, let's honor him. Don't touch his bones. They've got to stay there. And often that's part of journeying together, isn't it? We want to bring changes in the church bit by bit. We have to, because as culture moves on, we need changes. In fact, there's once a charismatic church in the southeast of England whose motto, whose slogan was, constant change is here to stay. And sometimes it's like that. But when you do make changes, remember and honour the past. I remember when at Belmont, we decided that we had to change the way in which women were allowed to operate in the church after 100 years of doing it another way. And one of the things I'm really glad that we were very careful about was to say to some of the older women who'd spent their lives in the church, this does not mean that everything you've done has been wrong. This does not mean that we don't honour what you've done over half a century. What you did was right for its time. And it was based on the understanding of Scripture that we had in those days. And you honoured God, you were faithful to him, and you were blessed in your ministry. And we honour that even as we move on to something different. And so he was good at that as well. Third, he was good at providing inspiration. He was good at helping people build memories. The massive Passover, the dramatic reading of the Bible by the pillar outside the temple. People were never going to forget those things. This weekend, I'm with the family celebrating my youngest daughter's 40th birthday and feeling very old. But anyhow, you know, it's great when you get the kids and the grandchildren together. The memories that we build together, they're all part of it. There's one grandchild, Lilia, who on holiday last year went to the toilet and looked at the ice cream bar, and she saw this list of names and signatures on the wall. And it was the cleaning rota for that toilet. And she didn't realize that. She just thought if you went to the toilet, you had to put your name on the list. So she put her name on the list. And so every time we get together now, Lilia, have you cleaned any toilets recently? And they won't let the story drop. Last year, I went to visit them all in Woolacombe when they were in a caravan park. And I took the kids down to buy an ice cream. And on the way back, I went into their own caravan where there were some people having lunch. And they will never let me forget that. Grandad, this is our chalet here. You've got that, haven't you? You know, and the same stories go on being retailed. And they build the bonds, don't they? That's a great thing. When you do things together, you build a shared history. That's what helps the thing become alive and real. Isn't that so? Then finally, staying humble, because we've got to finish here. I think the great thing about Josiah was he never thought too much of himself. He never thought he was doing more than he was. And when you look at the outcome of his life, it was great for a while. But then, well, first of all, he didn't get everything right. He died by going into an ill-chosen war against Pharaoh Necho. And he was just killed, struck down, and his son Jehoahaz came to the throne. Now, the Bible never condemns Josiah for taking that decision. It did say that he didn't listen to the word of the Lord that came through Pharaoh Necho. Yes, certainly. But would you go to a heathen emperor to hear the word of the Lord? And, you know, whereas in many cases it was, he sinned and so the Lord removed him. That's never said about Josiah. He just got it wrong. And the greatest Christians can sometimes get it wrong in trying to understand what God is doing. If you look back at the 19th century, for instance, when the Salvation Army were just starting to do amazing things with the classes in Britain that people could never reach. Lord Shaftesbury, who was himself one of the greatest social reformers of the 19th century, said that he thought the Salvation Army was a trick of the devil trying to make Christianity look ridiculous. I'm not a Pentecostal, but if you think of all that the Pentecostal movements achieved in the 20th century in evangelizing places like Latin America that nobody else was reaching, it's obvious that God has been behind so many things that have been done. Yet back in 1904, G. Campbell Morgan, one of the greatest preachers of his day, a godly man, said that he thought that the Pentecostal movement was the last vomit of Satan. We can get it wrong. And Josiah got it wrong too sometimes. Second, when you look at his legacy, his country lasted for only 2 decades more. He showed what could have been, but he didn't build anything for the future. And we need to remember that we mustn't live in the future, because we don't know how much of it God has got for us down here. The way we build our brothers and sisters, the way we share what we've got from God, the way we continue on the journey is here and now. And also, if you look at Josiah, he did a great thing for the country, but his family, It was an absolute mess. So he dies, and Jehoahaz, his second son, or, well, third one, but one was dead already. Oops, sorry. Oh, right, okay. His second son was put on the throne. He lasted just 3 months. And then Necho, on his way back from his battles, came and took Jehoahaz out. What's the Bible's verdict on Jehoahaz? He did evil. So then he took the first son, who they didn't want the first time because he was obviously a bad lot, and his name was Jehoiakim, and he put him on the throne. He managed to hang on for 11 to 12 years. Guess what? He did evil, says the Bible. When he was removed, his son was put on the throne, Jehoiakim. And Jehoiakim, well, again, he lasted for 3 months, but in that time, he did evil. And he was taken away, and there was only one left of the family. He was a son that nobody really wanted, that was Zedekiah. And so Zedekiah became the king. And he lasted for a few years, but once again, he did evil. And in 586, 87 BC, the country capsized and was taken away into captivity. And if you want to read what a disaster that was, read the Book of Lamentations, because it was one of the most traumatic moments in the nation's history. So this is the way it works. You can only do what you've got to do for your day. Your future impact is for God to determine. Your present calling is here and now with people. That's a journey.